The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Attention! Dress right! Dress! Parade! Press!
Good morning, pigs. Good morning, you fascists, you honkies, you killers, you bigots, you fags, you pinkos, you creeps, you bastards, fuzz.
This indoctrination of vocal harassment was compiled by our own juvenile division in preparation for the concert this weekend. Now, men, I'm going to talk to you this morning about self-control and law enforcement.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is Josh Johnson of Rewind This Movie.
Hi, nice to be here.
This week we're looking at Electroglide in Blue, a quasi-motorcycle movie, and much, much more. It's the story of John Wintergreen, played by Robert Blake, a motorcycle cop in Arizona who wants to trade in his iron horse for a Stetson and become a detective. He's got the chance with a fake suicide of an old-timer, Frank. That's really just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot more going on with this movie, which makes it something that has really stood the test of time. So, Josh, what stands out to you in regard to Electroglide in Blue?
There are a lot of things that stand out. It's really a favorite of mine. And I would say, for one thing, the fact that it was released in 1973 is really noteworthy because that was the year that America withdrew from the Vietnam War. And unlike other films that had come out prior to this, it feels like the ultimate end of the Vietnam War movie. You know, in the same way that other films like Easy Rider and other films had seemed to represent what was going on in the country, this is the only film that came out in 1973 that I actually think represents some of the attitudes that people were feeling in the time regarding that. It also has some amazing stunt work and some of the most beautiful cinematography that you could ever see in an American film.
Yeah, that's very true. So much of it is shot in Monument Valley, which kind of lends like this John Ford look to it. And it just, yeah, it's just absolutely gorgeous. These nice vistas of the red mountains and just how big the world is compared to this basically a dot, an insect of John Wintergreen, and that he's even played by a very diminutive actor makes it even, you know, he's even smaller because of that. Just, you know, he's the little guy trying to get through in the world, and just everything is pushing against him.
The smallest guy in the largest possible place. It's a really fun dynamic.
He's a good cop on a big bike on a bad road. I think I read that once. When we're introduced to Wintergreen, just the way that the camera is going along the line of all the cops, and then it has to go down to Wintergreen. They really play up throughout the entire film just how short he is. I mean, whether it's him next to these girls and just how tall the girls are compared to him, or the dialogue itself where he's talking about, you know, he and Alan Ladd being, you know, 5'4", the same height. I mean, that was even used on the poster, which is kind of a strange thing. But yeah, really playing up how tiny he is as he's really trying to scrabble and become something bigger. You know, he wants to fill these literally bigger boots than what he has currently. So what are you seeing as far as the similarities or the influences on the whole Vietnam withdrawal in Electric Light and Blue?
Well, what I think is different when you compare it to earlier films that kind of dealt with countercultural themes or the idea of freedom of the road, those films always took the stance of the sort of younger generation. They seemed to pose this idea that it was an us versus them kind of world. But what Electroglide, I think, illustrates a lot more clearly is that there's not really a clearly defined us versus them. You know, it actually shows a more conservative character, or a character that's on the opposite side of the law, who also is struggling and facing, you know, the total collapse of their environment. You know, it's the point where everybody, regardless of their political stance, had realized a certain amount of failure had occurred. And the film, it's not a defeatist film, but the film does present characters that are very much defeated. And I think that's a little more interesting and a little more dimensional than what you saw in a lot of the earlier countercultural films.
The freedom of the road that something like an Easy Rider represents, and then John wants to get off of his motorcycle, you know, so much throughout the film. I mean, there's the speech where he's talking about how he's just tied to this motorcycle. For him, there is no freedom of the road. He's basically patrolling the same, even though it's just gorgeous countryside, he's patrolling the same stretches of road over and over again. And for him, it's just this kind of, you know, mundane thing that he wants to get away from. And it's funny that his partner doesn't even want to go on patrol. He's just much rather would sit in the shade, read his comic books, and just enjoy life that way. And it's he's got his own dream of, you know, wanting to have a better motorcycle and a bigger motorcycle, and just, you know, that's where he gets off on. But John just wants to get away from that bike altogether.
And it really shows a kind of disdain for the attitude that you don't need to seize your own destiny. You know, the character of John Wintergreen knows that he's only going to achieve his dream by actively pursuing it. And he sort of appreciates maybe his partner for not having those same ambitions, but he's nonetheless very driven. And I think that's also something that is different from some of the earlier films, where they were a little bit more carefree. They were about doing what you wanted because it felt good. And this film strikes a pose of doing what you need to do to get what you want. It's actually, to me, I think it shows where we were headed with the kind of me generation that was to come, with being more consumer-based and shifting away from the freedom that the late 60s created.
Yeah, I love the relationship between the hippies and the cops in this movie. I mean, John is very much right there in the middle. You know, he wants to give everybody a fair shake as much as he possibly can. Zipper is very much representative. Zipper, his partner, is very much representative of the attitudes, I would say, probably more of the day, as far as, you know, planting drugs on the hippies and just really, you know, bashing them. And the scenes where John is just like, you know, trying to explain stuff to people and really, you know, he's honest to a fault. I mean, when he's giving the detective from Los Angeles a ticket, and the guy just can't believe it whatsoever. You know, why are you doing this to me? And I'm going to, you know, lash out with all that I can. John doesn't care. He's just, if you're wrong, you're wrong, and I'm going to give you a ticket. And if you're right, you know, the kid driving the microbus, if you're right and you're just, you know, carrying posters and rock paraphernalia and whatnot from one place to another, no problems. But, you know, Zipper is definitely not of that mindset. He's going to hassle every hippie that he possibly can. And if had it been Zipper pulling over that detective, probably would have let him go with the pass, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also interesting, you know, maybe we're jumping ahead too much to talk about the ending of the film, but the first time that John actually compromises somewhat and actually says, I owe you a favor, and, you know, recognizes something and lets somebody off, it ends tragically. You know, the first time that he actually allows himself to not be too hard-edged about something, it ultimately ends tragically for him. I think that's a really interesting statement to make.
Yeah, it never really rang true for me, the scene of John doing target practice at the police headquarters on the Easy Rider poster. That just doesn't feel like that's something that he would do. You know, he's not actively out there busting hippies and shooting at hippies and killing hippies, but though there, that does add that irony that it is a hippie that then, you know, puts him to his demise, and that it's, you know, the one time that the guy is carrying something illegal, and yeah, John's trying to help him out. But yeah, that was a rough, very rough, but yet very gorgeous ending to the film. We should talk, before we get into that too much though, about the whole, basically the rise and fall of John Wintergreen. I mean, the movie starts out with him as a motorcycle cop. He wants to be a detective desperately, and to your point of earlier, as far as like having to go out there and really strive for what you want and what you need, when he comes across the dead body of Frank, he just has to make this a murder. You know, it's not a suicide for him. He wants, you know, everything has to be checked, and he's just going through and really super aggressive with the coroner as far as how he needs to look at the body and touch the body, and, you know, and can't handle the evidence and all this kind of stuff. Really, again, by the book, there are certain procedures that you need to follow, and by God, he's going to make sure that you follow every single one of those. And in that instance, it actually works out for him, because there's another detective there, or a detective there, Harv Poole, who recognizes in Wintergreen something that he likes, and he's got the experienced gut feeling to know that there's something more going on with this case. Wintergreen maybe not doesn't have the gut, but he does want there to be more going on with it.
Hi, Doc.
You think there's any need for an investigation?
Look, Harv, my office is already over budget and the council's on my back. You want me to blow another $1,000 for an autopsy on some old bastard nobody gives a damn about?
Well, psychologically, I'd like to know why the old guy shot himself in the chest instead of the head, wouldn't you?
All right. I'll put him up for you.
Glad you feel that way about it, Doc.
Incompetence is the worst form of corruption. Glad there's somebody around here who understands that.
Yeah, you almost get the sense when you watch that scene play out that Wintergreen is more excited about the opportunity that he recognizes to, you know, start doing detective work, that he's more driven by that than anything he's actually picking up at the scene that, you know, seems to be evidence of any kind of foul play. I almost like to imagine that maybe this has happened before, that there's been a scene that he's stumbled across and that he always treats it that way, that he's always eager to try to find something that will take him out of his position. And we just happen to be privy to the time that it actually works.
I love that that leads to, you know, as he's not going to become a detective, but he's going to be Harv's driver. You know, still, he's still kept away from his goal in that way. But I love the scene of him putting on the Stetson and putting on the hat and the tie and all this kind of stuff and really kind of dressing up, you know, in the role that he wants to be finally. You know, you have to, dress for the job you want, not the job you have kind of thing. And then how he's undercut by the camera showing that he's not wearing any pants. You know, it's just the movie seems to be kind of operating under its own agenda and using John as a foil a lot of times to say like, oh yeah, here he is and he's really successful, but no, he's actually a clown and dancing around to this old song without any pants on.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I also think one of the things that the film does that is intriguing to me, at least, is that it portrays Wintergreen as a character who projects a tremendous amount of confidence. But then it also, you know, undercuts him so much that you have to assume that maybe that's more a projection than how he actually feels. You know, there's a great scene where he's flirting with these girls at this food truck. And he's very, you know, confidently laying out all of these things about Alan Ladd, et cetera, and flirting with this girl. And he comes across as extremely confident. And you actually see him in the very beginning of the film, you know, having an interaction with a woman that has clearly gone, you know, fairly well. But then throughout the movie, it seems to be almost embarrassing him. It exaggerates or accentuates how short he is or how far he is from his goals. So it does this weird mix where it keeps offering him up as this guy who's maybe, you know, to be admired or very charming, and then cuts him back down. It's like the film won't allow him to achieve his goals.
It's kind of like the scene when he's there interrogating the hippies at that kind of commune area. And he comes in and he does his usual thing where he tries to be nice and he tries to be respectful and asks some questions. He wants to know where Bob Zemko is because it seems like Zemko might have something to do with Frank's murder. That doesn't work out so well. You know, he comes back to Harv and says, no, everything's fine. Harv goes out and uses brutality, basically, and starts to get answers that way. So yeah, that's another undercutting of John where he's trying to do the right thing, can't quite do it because Harv has to beat the truth out of these guys. It's really a sad scene for me that we get to see Wintergreen really reacting well with these guys. You know, they're laughing and calling him Little Chief and these kind of things. Again, kind of undercutting him. He's walking away with his head held high, and then he has to lower it again when Harv comes back with actual proof of where Zemko is and a lead on where they can find this guy.
The way that scene plays out also speaks to the nature of the film in which the characters are so often defeated, because what's, you know, most important about that sequence is that he tries it the proper by the book way and doesn't get results. And then Harv comes in and uses savagery, but actually gets the information they need. So not only is Harv doing the wrong thing, he's doing the wrong thing and it's working.
And he's getting information that may ultimately not lead anywhere. There can be room for debate whether Zemko had anything to do with Frank's murder or not. You know, was it Willie, his possibly platonic roommate there? Was it really loneliness that drove Willie to kill Frank, or was it something else? So I know that we're kind of talking, or I am anyway, in very broad terms, and I'm trying not to give away too much to the folks at home, but I like that there is this kind of enigmatic quality to the film, you know, that you can believe John and believe that he solves the murder. But again, the movie has done so much to undercut every single time that he has put something forward that maybe he came up with the wrong answer on that one. Or maybe this time he was actually right. You know, it would be nice to believe that he was right in this instance. We should probably talk a little bit about Willie, who's played by Elijah Cook Jr., one of my favorite character actors, and he is just loony in this film, ranting and raving and going off.
You know, it's interesting. I did pull up some older reviews of the film, and I was really surprised to find that a lot of the performances were roundly criticized at the time. And I did find an interesting review that even pointed out Elisha Cook Jr. as being sort of a weak link in the film or not quite pulling off his role. And I found that to be very surprising because I think it's maybe one of the most effective portrayals of a mentally ill person that I've ever seen on camera. And yet, it didn't seem to go over well at the time for whatever reason.
I totally bought him. I love his performance. I think the guy that plays Harv Poole is absolutely terrific too. I like him, and especially when he finds out that maybe he's not, or he gets it called out in front of him that he's not as virile as he appears to be. That Wintergreen, for all of his faults, is actually a dynamo in bed. Jolene points that out, the woman that connects both of these guys. Again, poor John Wintergreen. He may get complimented that he's a dynamo in bed, but that's going to completely ruin any chances and puts him right back on that motorcycle again.
Yeah. Another performance that seemed to be pretty regularly criticized was the actress who plays Jolene. I read a number of people single her out, and they all seemed to point out that she seemed as though she were in a first-year acting class of some kind. And I actually thought she was incredibly effective, and I think that's an accurate reading, but it makes sense. She is kind of a failed actress, and what she's giving us in that big dramatic scene is a performance. And I actually thought that that really worked for the film and didn't, to me, seem amateurish or difficult to believe at all.
Well, I think that the actress who played Jolene was pretty much undercut by the script. I mean, I know we'll talk about this a little bit later on, but in talking to the screenwriters for the film, her performance, her one big performance that's right there at the heart of the film when they go into the honky-tonk or whatever, the detective's bar, basically, and she's there, you know, giving her whole life history and moving from this topic to that topic. You know, it was a few scenes in the film that they just eventually crammed into one.
Well, 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 my two knights in shining armor, Mr. Tall and Mr. Small. I'm sorry, but the place is closed. Hey, that don't matter because you're both very special. Come on in, gentlemen.
You ready to leave?
Harv, you're always on duty. Run, 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 run. You can't relax. But you know how to relax, don't you, Johnny? Hmm? Drinks for the gangbusters! Zap, zap, you're dead! And I'm offering you my hospitality, and it ain't nice to say no. So close the door, Harv. I ain't gonna bite you.
There's a great story, you know, that James William Garcia tells, if you watch his introduction on the DVD, about being behind schedule and just reaching into the script and yanking out 20 pages and saying, there, now we're back on schedule. So, of course, that role is the one that is most diminished by that choice. But it's interesting to think of somebody being that cavalier with a screenplay.
Yeah, really. It was his first time and only time directing. So, yeah, we'll definitely talk about that. And speaking of, why don't we go ahead, we'll take a break and come back with more from inside the projection booth.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
I'm going to go right ahead and jump to the interviews that I managed to procure for this episode. I tried my best to track down Robert Blake, but he's been kind of out of the public eye after his legal issues. Surprisingly, as I was asking if people knew contact information for him, a lot of people were under the impression that he's in jail. From what I understand, he was acquitted in 2005. Doesn't mean he's not guilty, but he was acquitted. So he was definitely not somebody I could talk to. And despite multiple emails and leaving voicemails for James William Garcia, I got bupkis. Never got a call back or anything. So I would have loved to have heard their interpretation of the events surrounding this film, because the two people I did talk to, Robert Boris and Rupert Hitzig, couldn't have told more different tales. It was a total Rashomon as I heard the unfolding of how Electric Light and Blue was made.
You like Rashomon?
That's not how I remember it.
Boris and Hitzig wrote the script for the film, and here's what they have to say about its origins.
I was coming out of advertising in New York City. I'd always wanted to do screenplays, and I had written a screenplay called The Day the Indians Beat St. Louis, and it was a Western about the very last Indian uprising that took place in the United States. And I carefully researched that it actually was in Colorado, and the four corners, where four states touched in the United States. And there was an actual Indian uprising that took place as late as 1916, and where about 4,000 Indians walked off a reservation, and they were actually herded back onto the reservation by modern military forces that were in preparations for entering into World War I, so they were in bivouacking. So the whole image of a bunch of Indians who were, you know, half-starving, some pickup trucks and some, you know, small vehicles and whatever they could get, and wagons and things like that, marching off a reservation, met by mechanized troops with tanks and machine guns, and being forced back onto the reservation. So I thought that was a fascinating image, and so I wrote that script. And it was a very good first full-length screenplay for me. It got me an agent, and I started talking to the agent about other things, you know, to try and write. And then somebody came to me and said, I think the agent or a friend of the agent came to me and said, Dustin Hoffman, who was at that point a big star, obviously, coming off of The Graduate and stuff, Dustin Hoffman was looking for a movie. Something had fallen out, and he needed a movie real fast. And I said, I had just come back from a trip, which I'd gone on the motorcycle. The most fascinating part of it was when I was in Arizona, in Phoenix. And I was driving through town, and this was just a short time after Easy Rider, I think. But anyway, I was driving through town, and they were in mourning for a motorcycle cop who had been shot by a bunch of hippies. And I felt like every eye in Phoenix was looking at me and saying, who is this guy, and who is this biker, and blah, blah, blah. I felt really weird. But it was fun. I didn't get into any trouble. There was nobody hassling me. But I was so impressed by what the town, how they were reacting to the death of this cop being shot by a bunch of hippies, that I started doing research in the newspaper and stuff like that. So when I came back home, and I got back to New York, and I heard that Dustin Hoffman was looking for a movie, I said, you know, he's never played a cop. What about a short, overachieving motorcycle cop? And I remembered this incident in Phoenix, and I said, and I just have seen something that kind of impressed me. I'm going to write this script. So I ended up writing a thing, which my first draft was called Pig, which was the nomenclature for cops in those days.
Okay, that was Bob Boris telling his version of the origin of Electric Glide in Blue. And now let's go ahead and turn over to Rupert Hitzig, who's going to tell his story.
When we wrote Electric Glide in Blue, and it came out of an incident that happened when I was with my sister in Arizona, a cop was killed at 2:30 in the morning from the back of his motorcycle. And I was in Phoenix during the 2 or 3 days afterwards during the wedding. And I saw this cortege of black leather motorcycle guys coming along the highway, escorting the cortege. And it was kind of shimmering with that desert heat. And it was amazing to see these 25 or so motorcycles surrounding this hearse. And I went to the library, and I found the editorials about the cop killing that took place at 2:30 in the morning. And the thing that was interesting to me was that the cop had black leather. So in our jargon then, he was a pig. The cowboys had shaved heads, you know, on the side like Marines, and they had guns in the back of their pickup trucks, and they were known as the cowboys. And the long hairs and the Vietnam protesters were the peaceniks or the hippies. And these labels didn't mean anything to me because Parle and Merkel, who were the two guys who killed the cop, were long hairs with a peace symbol on the side of their Volkswagen bus. And they rolled down the back window, threw a shotgun up, and blew the guy off the motorcycle at 2:30 in the morning. And I thought to myself, this is very, very bizarre, because they don't really know what was behind that black leather, and he doesn't know why he was stopping them, maybe to bust them for drugs, and maybe to say, I'm sorry, I busted you another time. Maybe he was going to apologize for something that maybe he'd done. So that was where the whole... So I came back from Phoenix blown away by the experience. I had paid my friend Bob Boris. I had found him in West Virginia, and I wanted to make movies, so I had optioned an Evan Hunter book called A Horse's Head, and we were writing a movie script in my farm in Woodstock, and he was living there, and I was paying him $150 a week, and I said, put that thing away, we're going to do something else. We're going to do the flip side of Easy Rider, we're going to do a film called Pig, and we started to work on it. I paid him $150 a week to co-write with me, and we wrote it together. I was very giving in those days because I had so much going for me, that I thought that Bob should get the writer's credit. I was going to get the director's and the producer's credit. So I didn't put my name as a co-writer, even though I was a co-writer, very much a co-writer, because it was my story, and I was very much involved in a lot of the scenes. But I was in my 20s, and I didn't know the value of residuals, and I didn't know the value of credits. And so I just said, you're the writer, I'm the director, and let's go to work. And we did. The idea for the film came even before the shooting, the idea for the character. I produced the Playboy show in 1969 in Los Angeles, and I had a silver Porsche Targa. And when I was finished with it, I was so fed up with I was unmarried, and there were so much women, so many women, and I was exhausted. And I have this one beautiful girlfriend back in New York, and I wanted to see her. So I decided to drive my Porsche across the country without stopping, see if I could do it. I did it in 52 hours and 18 minutes, but I stopped in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I couldn't go any further. But during the course of the drive, I was going through the desert in Arizona or New Mexico, and you could see the highway in front of you for 10 miles. Then you could see this cross-section. You could see the highway on the right 5 miles and 5 miles on the left. It was just completely barren. But in the middle of this barren desert, where there was a stoplight hanging from a cord over the crossroads, it was dangling in the wind. And as I saw it, I was going about 120 because there were no speed limits then. And I saw this spotlight turn to orange, turn to yellow, And I shifted down, and I stopped when it turned red. And I thought, how f***ing ludicrous this is. I'm sitting here. I can see 5 miles to my left, 5 miles in front of me, but this red light in the middle of the desert, I'm like Pavlovian. I stopped. And then when it turned green, I started. And there was a billboard, and behind the billboard was a motorcycle cop. And that was where the whole idea for Johnny's character came from, that the idea of him at the beginning of the film thought that the speed limit was the law, so there were no extenuating circumstances. The law is the law, and we don't bend it. So all that subtext got kind of lost. I was only in my mid-20s, but as a documentarian from CBS, I was invited by Harvard, where I went to college, and I was the chairman, was president of the Hasty Pudding, and a filmmaker at that particular point. And I was invited in 1966 to come up to Harvard, to the Carpenter School of Visual Education, and talk to the students about documentaries, making documentaries, because I was working for CBS. So I did, and a kid came to me out of one of the, it says, I want to make features. And I said, we all want to make features. I said, look me up when you get to New York. So he graduated a year later in 1967. And he called me and he said, okay, now what do I do to get a feature? I said, look, I've made 19 documentaries. I want to make a feature. And I guess what you have to do is you have to find a script that you really love. So 3 months later, he called me and said, I've written a script called Out of It. And I said, okay. I read it and I said, well, I don't think a major will do this, but they might. What you've got to do is find yourself a sucker. And somebody will put the money up. You can do this for $100,000. This is your story. So, and I can help you get the rental, film rental, because my brother-in-law was renting 16mm equipment. And I said, just do a 16mm film. So he called me 3 months later and he said, I've got my sucker. And I met with the sucker. It was Ed Pressman. And Ed Pressman was a toy manufacturer and he wanted to go in the film business. And we sat at the Harvard Club and talked about it. And I got them 50% off on the camera rental and they made the film. And they made the film because he attached himself and said, I'm not going to, if I don't do it, nobody's going to do it. So when I finished Pig, I went to the William Morris agency and they said, well, they all met with me because I had some pull there because Nat Lefkowitz had brought me in. He was the president of New York. And he had a meeting with all the guys, Larry Auerbach, Peter Lampeck, Marv Minoff, Sandy Lippman. They were all sitting around this room and I came in and they said, we've read your script. We think it's good. Who's going to direct it? And I looked at them and said, I'm going to direct it. And they said, oh, there's no way you can direct it. You know, you have no feature experience. And a man named Peter Lampeck was an agent. He said, I've got it. I got a guy. If he likes your script, we got a deal because he has a three-picture deal. He's only got two pictures still. He'll direct it. He'll get your picture. And he said, I said, who is it? He said, his name is Paul Williams. Well, that was the kid that had come to me 3 years earlier at Harvard and said he wanted to direct features. Now he was going to be attachable. And why was he going to be attachable? Because he hung out and said, I want to do Out of It. So I said at that particular point, gentlemen, I'm going to direct it. And that was it. I started the process. I had a lawyer from Harvard who was my friend, dropped out of the law profession. So we started raising money for a $720,000 budget. And I went to a lot of my father's patients. He was a doctor. And they would say, I don't like the guy swearing on page 55. You change that, I'm good for $25,000. And if you change this, then I'll change. I was going crazy when I got a call that a guy named Jimmy Guercio had gotten the script from his actor friend, Kenny Silk, who found it on the floor in the William Morris Agency, and he liked to read scripts. So this little guy who had produced Chicago called me up and asked me and my fiance, or my girlfriend, and Karen, who's now my wife, to come to Sutton Plaza, and he said, I'll send a car for you, and you come and have dinner with me. Let's talk about the film.
A very important record impresario named James William Guercio, who owned Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Chicago, two very big bands.
So I went to Guercio's on the back of a limousine, because he was a music producer, so he had limousines up the yin-yang. And we went up to the penthouse, and Lucy Angle, who was not married to Jimmy then, sat downstairs while we went up on the roof of the Sutton Plaza apartment. He said, tell me how you see the movie. And I talked for 2 hours. We came downstairs, and went over the desk, and he wrote a check for $10,000. He said, here's an option for 10 days. Yes, you're going to direct it. I'm going to produce it. Here's a check for $2,500. I want you to leave tomorrow for Phoenix and do the scouting, do the storyboards. And if you don't hear from me within 10 days, keep the $10,000 and go about your ways. So I did.
I was with a guy who was, his name is Rupert Hitzig. I was with a guy named Rupert who actually gave me $150 a week for 10 weeks to write the script. So I got $1,500 to write the script in those days. and he paid my rent, I guess. And he came. He was going to be the director. We were friends, and he was going to be the director, and I was the writer. And all of a sudden, this guy Guercio was whining and dining us. You know, we want to make this. I want to make this movie. I think it's great, and blah blah blah. And he took us out to fancy places, and he obviously was very well connected. And so that was the start of it. Another guy, I think his name was Ralph Serpy, who was a representative for Dino De Laurentiis. He got a hold of the script too. And he went after us too, and he wanted to make the movie. Dino wanted to make it, this is my first screenplay actually going out in the marketplace, and it was pretty heady stuff for me. It was my first script, and already people fighting over to make it a movie. So I was kind of excited. We met with Serpi and De Laurentiis. We met with Guercio, and Guercio was this young hit guy with a hot band in Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And so we said, okay, well, we just obviously went with the rock guy.
I went to Phoenix. I was there for 9 days with Bob Boris, who was my partner, the writing partner, and we got all the locations. And on the 9th day, I hadn't heard anything. I got a phone call from Jimmy's secretary, who said, be in Los Angeles, the ticket's prepaid, at 2:30 at the Polo Lounge, you're going to meet with David Picker, the president of the United Artists. And I did, and I sat there, and he said the same thing to me that Jimmy said to me, how do you see the movie? And I went through it from that opening sequence, which you saw in the movie, all the way through to the end, the way I saw the movie, the changing tones, the reason that the guy was doing it, why he became a softer man, and then the misunderstanding at the end when he got killed. And David Picker turned to me at 5 o'clock and said, you're going to direct this for United Artists. He was just married to a woman named Joy Manhoff. And I said, where's Joy? And he said, down at the pool. And I let out a whoop that I was as loud as anybody could hear. And yee-haw! And I went down to the pool. I celebrated. We bought a bottle of champagne with Joy Manhoff and David Picker and Jimmy Guercio. And that was the beginning of what turned out to be a nightmare.
What I remember most of all was on a Friday, David Picker, who was the head of United Artists, got the script from Guercio. And he was flying to Los Angeles, and it was a night flight or something like that. Anyway, when he got to Los Angeles, and this was a Friday night, something like 11, 12 o'clock our time, whatever it was, I got a call directly from David Picker in L.A. He said, I just landed, and I read your script on the plane, and I love this script, and we're making this movie.
6 months later, he stole the thing from me 3 days before we were going to shoot. After I'd done all the casting, all the storyboards, everything else, he just stole it. And he had me fired. David Picker said, you're out. Blake won't work with you. Well, Blake had been given 5% of the table to work with Guercio. And Blake didn't like it. I was strong-willed, and he wanted one of his friends to play Harf Poole, and I didn't want the guy. I wanted somebody else. And when I overruled Blake, and he was just a tyrant anyway, I guess it turned out that his anger and his temperament.
I wrote that shot where the camera pans along the cops and then pans down that fine, Wintergreen. Two heads shorter than everybody else, and then comes back up to the next cops. That's in the script. So this was never a question of, it was changed, for Blake. That was always the idea of the character.
I was such a big fan of Bobby Blake's. When I saw in Cold Blood the scene at the window when it's raining outside and they had the tears, and I just felt this guy. And they didn't want me, neither Guercio nor Tommy Shaw nor David Picker wanted me to go with Blake. He wanted me to go with Marty Sheen. And I just said, I know Blake, I can make him a leading man. And I got him a motorcycle to practice on, and I went on a diet so that he would go on a diet. And I made him go in the sun so he'd be tan. And we ate our tuna fish out of a can. I mean, it was unbelievable that he turned on me. Unbelievable.
Well, I was sitting in the audition in Los Angeles where Blake came in. And Blake wanted to play the part. And he came in to read for the part and talk about it. And he walked in, and he was, looked like a fairly decent height and all that stuff. And he was, normal size or a little, just an inch or two shorter. And he said, You know why I got to play this fucking part? And Rupert said, no, why do you have to play this part? And he said, because I understand this guy like nobody else does. And then he took off his boots, and there was obviously lifts in his boots. And he took off both of his boots, and he shrunk maybe 4 inches. And suddenly he would drop down. He said, because I know this fucking guy. And that was pretty impressive show and tell. That was if we weren't sure Blake was the guy, although we loved him in Cold Blood, if we weren't sure Blake was the guy, that proved it. So that was always the concept. It was always a short guy.
Well, what happened on the Thursday before when I was fired was we were rehearsing. We were in the 9th day of rehearsal.
at 8600 Melrose, and we were in Jimmy's office in the conference. No, in Jimmy's office, and we were rehearsing for about the seventh day with everybody there. And Connie Hall, who I'd convinced to come out of quasi-retirement to shoot it, came over to say goodbye because he was driving down with the camera with the crane, and we were going to start shooting the following Monday. 3 days later, came in to say goodbye. He left. We went in to just do a wrap up. It was the last day of rehearsals. And the night before that Thursday, on Wednesday night, I'd had an idea, and that was to put Greenbush, Zipper, in a scene which had been a single scene for Blake, where he looks in the mirror and tries on the detective's jacket, puts on the hat, and looks at himself in the mirror. And I thought it would be doubly poignant if Zipper looked through the door and saw him doing that, so that so I wrote that scene where he came up in the elevator of the apartment, and he had a six-pack of beer, and he was going to give him a gift as a going-away, kind of, six-pack of beer was his going-away gift, but inside he was churning because he was losing his partner, and he saw him through the door, through the window. He saw Blake dressing up and putting on the cowboy hat, and Blake read the screen. I said, there are a couple new pages that Thursday, and he looked at them, and it was quiet in there, and you could see his face was getting red. Suddenly, he threw his script, which was in a binder, he threw it across the table at me. And he scrambled across the top of the table, and he started to go for me. And I was taking karate class, and I went into karate pose. And he looked at me and put his finger in my face. He said, this picture is not big enough for both of us. And he walked out, and I was shaking. And Mitch Ryan, who's a friend who lives a block from here, will corroborate that. He said to me, God, I said to everybody, just go home. We'll see you down in Phoenix. Mitch said to me on the way out the door, that's about the worst thing I've ever seen in the movie business. I was left alone in that office, and I sat there shaking. And I walked over to the window, which had a Japanese garden in front of it, and I looked out. It was onto the parking lot. And there was Jimmy Guercio and Blake in the parking lot laughing with Blake's arm around Jimmy Guercio. And the phone rang. And the phone rang was David Picker and said, you're off the picture. And I said, well, don't do that. I own the script. He said, no, you don't. You signed it over on Monday. It's on property of United Artists. And I had. So I called my agent, I called my lawyer, Bob Montgomery, I called Marvin Minoff. Nobody was willing to go up against UA, and nobody fought for me. Part of the condition of getting $38,000, which was my buyout, was that I would go back to New York and leave them alone and not go to the set. So my dream was just pretty much shattered.
Lincoln Lodge was a big part of Horror Story. I mean, it was a fascinating experience. I was there for part of it, not all of it. What happened basically was that the producer or director at some point decided that he was going to direct the movie. I mean, it's as simple as that. It was one of those typical Hollywood stories. There began to be a lot of conflict. The producer and Robert Blake formed an alliance. They got into conflicts with Rupert, who was my friend, who was going to direct it. Some battles erupted, and the next thing I knew, Rupert was out. For me, they came to me and said, okay, are you sticking with the movie or are you leaving with Rupert? And I said, look, it's my baby. This is my script. I came up with the idea. You're birthed it, for God's sake. So I said, I'm not leaving. You know, I'm going to try and make the best movie possible because I love this thing. So I stuck around. At first, they were saying, because of the contest, Guercio was going to try and Blake were going to try and look for a director, and they talked to some big people and whatever it is. And I just knew that they were never going to find a director. I just knew there was no big names that were going to come on and make this thing. In about 2 weeks or something like that before, almost literally about a few days before we were supposed to go to Phoenix to film them, to make the movie, Guercio met with me and said, you know, it's a difficult decision, but I've decided I can't find the right director for this movie. I'm going to direct it myself. And I said, well, somehow that news fails to surprise me. But, okay. I stuck with it for a while. I went down, but I was clearly... I raised a lot of questions. I was not a welcome entity on my baby. And so I stayed there for a while. Then it just seemed very clear that I was not welcome there or be comfortable. So I left. I brought in some friend of Guercio's or Blake's to do some polishing, which I didn't like the cuts and the polishes they did. They did something, I mean, they didn't really, they edited the script more than anything else.
Then I had that shot at the end. And I had a thing on my original script that said, on April 27th, 1969, a motorcycle cop was shot, gunned down from the back of a moving VW bus with a peace symbol on the sign. The first officer to be killed in the line of duty in 52 years, ... And that's the fucking truth. And that was the super over the end of that last shot. And then I had talked to John Eastman, who was a friend of mine who represented the Beatles, and I had the rights to Imagine. And Guercio dumped Imagine because he wanted the publishing. Again, greed. And he made it a second-rate film. It could have been 4 stars. and it would have launched my career. That's all I wanted to do all my life, was to direct.
The real truth of it is that this thing was directed mostly by Bobby Blake and Connie Hall.
Blake wanted to direct the actors, and that's what Guercio gave him, because Guercio had never been on a set in his life. He didn't know the difference between camera left and camera right. So the deal that was made was, there was a very nice man who had 11 children who was the production manager, who had been the production manager for Richard Brooks. I mean, I had my team in there, Tommy Shaw. Rita Riggs was my very dearest friend. She was a costume designer. All these people were there, and Tommy Shaw got bought. Blake made a deal with Tommy and gave him 5%, as he gave Blake 5%. And Tommy Shaw didn't stand up for me when Vicker called him. He said, no, I think you should replace him. And he just did it for his 11 kids, mouthful. And Rita was there completely with me. Bob Boris turned on me. He didn't want to give up his first experience in movies. So even though I'd paid him and found him and brought him to Woodstock and paid him for a year, he went down with the company and was on the set the whole time. But I went home to New York with my tail between my legs and pretty shattered, and that changed the course of my life, because I went to work for Joe Papp, and I was the head of television for the Public Theater, and I was a producer, and then because I was a producer, that led to more producing, and then I became Alan King's partner. When Electroglide opened, before it opened, it was a huge hit in Cannes, and I still own 23% of the picture. And Guercio's attorneys called me and offered me $10,000 a point, $230,000, to take my name off it and to give me back the points. $230,000 in 1971. Can you imagine? My wife said, don't give him anything. This prick, she managed Terry Southern. She was the agent for Terry Southern on Easy Rider. She said each percentage point on Easy Rider was worth $1 million. So I turned it down, and my total distribution and profits was about $37.56. But, you know, as I said, I'm not going to be bitter. I mean, the only person I would like to see suffer for it, and he has, is Jimmy Guercio. He was an amoral, low-life crook. And 5 years after he allegedly, they used my storyboards for the opening. When I was sitting in my farm in Woodstock about a year later, I was having my coffee in the kitchen, and there was a butcher block table in the center of the kitchen, and we always got the New York Times, and I was standing there with my coffee, and I opened up the calendar section, the art section of the New York Times, and there was a two-page, not one-page, two-page spread on the opening of Electroglide in Blue. And across the top was America's newest director. And there was a picture, not of Robert Blake, there was a picture of Jimmy Guercio in jodhpur pants carrying a crop. And that's the way they sold the picture, which is why it went down the tubes. And it aggravated Blake to the point where when I heard that what Blake said about that advertising campaign, you know, was ludicrous. But Vicker was amoral, and Guercio was in his pocket, and vice versa. Vicker wanted to get more involved in the rock and roll world, and so he made a deal with the devil.
I remember when, because I had been away from the film for a while, I kind of, you know, left it, and so I was gone for a while. And next thing I was invited to the opening. I got the news that it was selected as the official U.S. entry to the Cannes Film Festival, which in those days was a big thing. You didn't just throw your movies at the Cannes, you were actually invited, and we were official U.S. entry. They were, in competition, they were official entries. So Electroglide was chosen as an official U.S. entry. That's pretty big shit. And I was really pumped about that. So I knew that had happened. I'd heard about that. I was excited about that. Then the next thing I know, I was actually with my friend Rupert on a weekend, and we opened the New York Times on a Sunday. And there on a Sunday, in the middle of the movie section of the New York Times, was a double-page ad. It was in those days called, I guess it's still a double truck ad. It was a two-page ad with a huge open space. One page is almost blank, and just some credits on it on the bottom. And one page had a picture of Guercio, you know, this little guy, in riding jodhpurs and kind of like a beret. The only thing we're missing was the riding crop and the megaphone. And it said, a great new American film by a great new American director, Electroglide in Blue. Well, right away, I thought that was the kiss of death. The one thing you don't tell critics is that this is a great new film and it's a great new director. They want to discover the guy. They want to say it. They don't want you to say it. So I knew I said, oh my God, this is the kiss of death. And you just can't do that. And it was just the most outrageous ad I've ever seen in my life. I was not expecting much when I was invited to the opening night at the Ziegfeld in New York, which is a big theater. And it was a big, big event, and all that stuff was kind of cool. And I went to the movie, and I saw Guercio, and I saw some of the people, and Picker came up, was very warm and friendly. And you know, it was a lovely event.
I got 2 silver tickets, and I saw the way they were promoting it. And I just turned down $230,000, so of course I went to see my cash cow. Not good. It was a horrible night. Because I kept my distance from Garcia, was there, and Lucy was there, and Lucy Angle, who had been my friend. And no, it was I was just gone from the scene.
From the opening scene, when the guy presumably commits suicide, and the way Connie Hall shot it, which, by the way, almost every shot was written in the screenplay, so I was really excited. I said, that's the way I wrote it. It was just, the opening was just dazzling, I thought. And I've looked at it since several times, and some big screenings and theater screenings and special events, and it does still hold up remarkably well. It's just a filmic experience. If Connie was the greatest, certainly the greatest American DP, I think, ever. So it had a wonderful opening. It was just spectacular. I watched it at the beginning. I felt sympathy for Blake, and I thought the highways were great, and I thought Arizona was fabulous, and I thought Blake was just so charming, and you cared about this little guy, and he was funny, and he was good, and I really liked it. I thought everything was really great, and they didn't add anything to my script. They didn't add any new scenes. All the scenes I had written, it wasn't anything I didn't write. They trimmed some things down, but that you expect that. And at one point in the middle, I turned to my girlfriend at the time, and I said, this movie is terrific. It's really good, and look how it's shot just brilliantly. And Blake is great.
I would have made the film a lot differently. I thought that Peter Cetera and all the guys on the bikes were ludicrous. It wasn't the way I envisioned it at all. And
Garcia, I know, had gone off to shoot some extra action in the chase scene, and I just thought some of the violence was over the top. The cops riding over somebody with the car, I thought that was a bit much. So there were a couple of things I thought were over the top. So I felt that the first half of the movie, if it had kept the way it was going, it actually could have been terrific, but I felt they kind of lost what they had, and they kind of broke my heart.
And I went in and sat down, and we were going to go like, this is going to be shit. This movie is not going to work at all.
I didn't like the performances. I don't think it was well directed.
And then all of a sudden in the middle, there's this sequence where Jolene does her dance hall, I Want to Be a Rockette scene. And they put about 3 scenes that I had written together into one. And she goes into a tirade that lasts about, to me, it felt like an hour, but it's probably only about 4 minutes or something like that. But it's endless, never-ending time on the screen and in the middle of a movie. And most of all, it was totally unmotivated. It came out of nowhere. In other words, what I had done is I had kind of carefully built up that she was, you know, working in the restaurant or the bar, and she was waiting on tables, and she was making friends with a little bit with Bobby Pike, but also with Harb, and so you could see that there was a pull there, and you could see that Harb's jealousy was beginning to surface. Well, the way the script was originally done was that there were a couple of scenes at the cop restaurant, cop bar, cop cafe, where Jolene was serving, and then so sometimes because she was stunned, first the first scene would have her stunned to find Wintergreen walking into the restaurant and sitting down next to Harb in a detective suit. She never expected that. You have to make a moment out of that. It's like, holy shit, I've been with this biker who is basically a second-class citizen. I'm with this biker cop and who hangs out at a different place altogether, and suddenly he's walking into the detective bar, a restaurant, in a suit with Harb as his partner. That's a moment, man. That's a moment you make something of, and you go like, holy shit, what's going to happen when she goes over to that table? Because the audience knows that Wintergreen's been fucking her, and now they get a sense that she's been banging with Harb. You go, holy shit, and so what's going to happen? So I think I had broken it down into about 2 or 3 times where they had brief dialogue at the table, and where in each subsequent time, one time Jolene went back when John came in with Harb, and she took a drink. So at least then you understood, oh, wow, this is too much for her. And then she couldn't help herself. She went to the table, hey, Harb, how are you? And he was, you know, real warm, and, you know, this is, you know, my woman kind of thing. And he was warm in the script. He was real warm with her. And then she said, and how are you feeling today, John? Whatever it was double entendre shit. And at least, you know, and then Harb starts to react. At least you know, holy shit, someone's going to explode here. So you build it up, and you saw that she's starting to take a flask out of her purse and take a hit. You realize, oh, this is not good. And then at least when the explosion hits, you understand, you know, and there's a reason for it.
it really bothered me that all of a sudden, boom, she's going to this humongous tirade. It changed the tone and the feeling of the film to me. And you don't know what inspired it. You don't know why was she drinking? In other words, all of a sudden they walk in there and she's half drunk. She's in her cups, as we would say. She's half drunk. And at least if there had been a scene at the table with Harv, you know, was there and she's kind of teasing Wintergreen, and Harv is looking at her and says, "What the fuck is, what is this?" And she said, "Nothing, Harv, nothing." At least motivate what she did. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they walk into the bar. We never knew that she had even questioned their relationship, or that he had questioned their relationship, or anything. There was no scene in there that even remotely suggested it. Basically, they walk in and she's drinking, and for some reason, she decides to spill her guts. And she goes like, "Well, Harv, you don't know, and you're in, what kind of man you are." Now, I didn't write. I would never have a character say, you know, I would be much more subtle than that, than just saying, you know, "And here, we know what kind of man you are, Harv." I just thought that was bad compression of scenes, some bad lines given to her, and totally unmotivated outbursts. And movies are remarkably unforgiving. If you're going along with a story and a character, and they suddenly something happens that's so jarring and doesn't fit, it takes you out of it. People are quick to lose it. And I felt that was a total mistake. I didn't understand it, and I kind of was angry about it.
And I don't think he captured what I wanted for Bobby's transition. What my story really was about, and what I was going to do with the costumes, were really going the way I'd arranged it. If you would come to this costume parade with Rita Riggs, you could see this list of Bobby's costumes from the beginning, civilian costumes, that he wore glaring red shirts and black snacks when he was off duty. It went through a gradation through the movie. So at the end of the movie, he was wearing browns and colored browns. So it went from this bright, you know, my story about the thing was that Blake's character, Johnny Wintergreen, didn't know how to make love at the beginning. He was like the fuck women. But what he learned through Melissa and through he learned through his experience, and that's why he changed over to, for more compassion, was he learned how to make love. And so all of that was the softening of the character was an extremely important arc for me. I think he lost a great opportunity to be, you know, Tony Bill, who did Sting, has been always known as a successful producer because he produced a movie that was great. Guercio shouldn't have had such horrible ambition. He had never been on a movie set in his life. He should have let me direct it. I mean, he should have continued with the promises that he made. We all know he was fired after 10 days on Tom Horn. And that gave me a great deal of pleasure, I must tell you. He was given, they didn't even tell him in person. Steve McQueen handed him a postcard and said, "Your services are no longer required," after the 10th day of shooting. And now I'm very good friends with Lauren James, who I had lunch with last week, who doubled McQueen for 21 years. And he and I always chortle about this because he was there. I was so insecure at the end of it. I did 10 years with Alan King, and I said, "I'm doing this to direct." But then I was so good as a producer, and we had so much stuff going on, that for 10 years I did nothing but produce Saturday Night Live, produced three movies, four television movies, five situation comedy pilots. But I never got back to directing, so that's why I left him after 10 years, which was a wonderful situation for me. I mean, I couldn't have been better. I loved him, and we were great friends. I gave him 6 months' notice. I said, "Alan, it's been 10 years. I haven't directed. I'm now 46, and I got to go to California and direct something." I'm at this point in my life, I still think I'm going to direct next week, you know, and I just had a casting session on my last film, but I'm going to have to pay for it myself. I mean, there's nobody waiting for me to direct a movie. So Electroglide, that was what I was going to do. My documentaries before Electroglide were really good, and that's where I was going. And it just changed the course of my life, which is okay because I'm very happy. I'm not where I want to be in that particular part of my professional life, but I've been successful enough to be happy.
I don't know about you, Josh, but I found that absolutely fascinating that people's memories can be so different. I mean, I know that this was 73 when this movie came out, but just the different stories, I mean, every point, you know, that was this film written with Dustin Hoffman in mind, you know, or was the film written and then they found the smaller actor, you know, those kind of things. I mean, nothing. They had nothing to agree about other than maybe that the director wasn't that nice of a guy. So I really wish I could have talked to him about this, but unfortunately, it was ducking my calls. I know Chicago is out there touring and stuff, and, you know, I did find that they were playing in a couple different cities, and he's playing with them. So he's out on the road and stuff. But yeah, that was a tough break not to be able to hear from him or from Robert Blake. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about the making of the film. You had mentioned Guercio's intro on the DVD. I'm hoping that you got a chance to listen to that riveting audio commentary that's on the DVD.
One of the things that's most interesting about the production of the film, when you look at it today, is that it seems like it would be virtually impossible to make this film, you know, in today's world because of the increase in traffic and, you know, the population of that location, and also just things like unions. I mean, I think it would be difficult to make a film like this with the level of stunt work and road work and not spend well over what they had to spend at the time. But the other thing that's really intriguing, or that I really enjoyed, was hearing of Guercio's love of Westerns and growing up on Westerns and having an opportunity to shoot all of the exteriors here as though he were filming a Western. One of the things that Guercio mentions is when he's talking about working with Conrad Hall on the cinematography, that Hall was not particularly interested in shooting the exteriors that way, and that he sort of laid down the law and said, you can use whatever lenses you want, whatever filters you want. You can shoot all of the interior scenes, you know, however you most want to experiment. But when we're shooting those exteriors, we're filming a Western.
So I was totally joking around when I said that his audio commentary was riveting, just because he doesn't say hardly anything at all. It's one of these, like, I ripped the audio commentary and was listening to it in my car, and I might as well have just ripped the regular audio, because he speaks so infrequently, and there are so many times, I think he says it at least twice, like, I don't want to talk about the making of this movie. And it's like, okay, why are you doing an audio commentary track then? It's like, thanks a lot for sharing all of these wonderful stories with us.
Yeah, I'm not verbal enough for you. I don't communicate this stuff. That's what I did with the pictures. The communication is in the image. So it's hard for me to talk about it because I think the work speaks for itself.
Well, it's weird because he seems genuinely proud of the movie and seems to really feel pleased with its place in history. So it's not like it's a film he wants to distance himself from. It just seems that he doesn't enjoy the process of revisiting it or talking about it. It's more, it seems like that process itself is unappealing to him. But I gather that he really likes the movie, which, you know, it would be far more disappointing to me if he just didn't want to talk about the movie because he was embarrassed about it.
I can't say that it's strange, but it's just, I would have liked to have seen more of what Guercio could do if he could do stuff, because it seemed like, you know, according to Hitzig anyway, film was stolen out from under him, and Guercio is very much the bad guy in that whole story. So I'm curious, had he been able to make another film, not been fired off of that Steve McQueen film, had he been able to make that or something else, what would have happened? But it's always interesting to me when a director just makes one film and you just get that, you know, there is no body of work. It kind of really undoes that whole cahier du cinéma auteur theory, where it's just like, I want to know more of what this guy's doing. And in order to do that, I really need to see more than one film.
Yeah, because you don't know how much of what came through in the film is circumstantial or other people's work or the influence of certain factors. I think it was James Caan, and I'm, you know, paraphrasing here, had a great statement where he talked about how people often ask him, or they're curious about how, when he works with first-time filmmakers, why these debut films are so amazing. And his response was something like, you know, when a first-time filmmaker is working on a film, they don't know what they're doing, so they just trust in all of the experts that are surrounding them. And that's why sometimes you have that sophomore slump where somebody who seems to be this, you know, brilliant new voice can't pull it off the second time around, because that time they're confident enough to follow their own voice and they don't really know what they're doing. And it would be interesting to see later work by Guercio and get a sense of what his actual voice is and what his abilities are.
Well, yeah, it's funny that you say that, because I mean, a few weeks ago I talked about The Woman Chaser, and that was Robinson Dvorak's first film. Next week you and I and Skiz will be talking about The American Astronaut, and you know, that wasn't Corey's first film, but his first feature. So yeah, it's interesting that we're talking about so many first-time filmmakers. And a few weeks ago we talked about Robert Culp's Hickey and Boggs, and there was nothing else that followed that one. So yeah, it would be interesting to see more. I mean, it's nice that with DeVore and with Maccabee we can see more of their body of work and see what else that they're doing. I mean, I guess even with Timothy Carey and The World's Greatest Sinner, we've got tweets, but there's nothing, there's no other feature film work that he did where we could really compare the two films and any common themes that he might have coming out of there. So I was lucky enough to track down a copy of the script just because there was so much controversy going on with the script and, you know, different versions and all those kind of things. And the script is fascinating. I mean, not just in what is in the script, but just the way that the script is actually formed. I mean, the one that I have was a revised draft from 1971, and Bud Atkins, who is one of the stunt guys, might have been the stunt coordinator, has his name written on this. I don't know if he wrote it himself or if somebody else wrote this and gave it to him. And it's really neat because throughout the screenplay, there are sections that have been revised, and they're all dated 2872, and they're in like this old school computer font, like the old dot matrix stuff. And they, rather than retyping the entire script over again, just these pages are kind of slid inside of here, where you might get an extra scene. You know, there will be a scene that's on one of the dot matrix pages that plays again on one of the regular pages. So it's just this kind of really confusing script, but it's neat too, because there are things throughout it. Like, there's this whole, the section that we were talking about earlier with the Volkswagen bus and the way that the movie ends, that is set up through the entire film. As we're going through here, there are all these shots, and they're shot very, it has the direction of how it's supposed to be shot in the screenplay. And they talk about these special moments is what they're called. So I'm going to read one of these here. This is scene 134, exterior Volkswagen bus day. The second special moment in the film, and I'm pausing because there are all these ellipsi in here. The movement is stop action stills again and total silence. It is morning, and it is beautiful, and it is delicate, and the group is gathered around the back of the bus, and it is parked in the middle of an Indian reservation, and they picnic with some incredibly old faces, wrinkled and beautifully leathered faces that move an inch at a time. The wine is passed, inch by agonizing inch, and an Indian woman smiles, inch by inch, and the hippie bus driver carves a slice of lamb with a huge knife, inch by, and then seriously, just dot, 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 and then smash cut to the next scene with roaring down the highway, that kind of stuff. So it's just, yeah, it's fascinating to read the way that things were different. And I know that, I believe it was Boris had pointed out that there were all these different scenes. You know, Jolene had a whole lot more to it. And what really got me was the woman that John falls in love with, Lori, who we see briefly. She's basically the same girl that Harv gets some answers out of at the hippie commune. And John starts a relationship with her, and it's this whole thing, and her parents, and John's got this other car, and he loves his car, and it shows up, and, you know, he's like showing up at her parents' place and taking her off and all this kind of stuff. And she's Zemko, or in this version, it's not Bob Zemko, obviously, but she's the Zemko character's girlfriend. And eventually they take off, and towards the end of the film, they get on a bus, and John is chasing that bus. So it's one bus that he chases where, you know, things are bad because she's going away from him, but things aren't quite as bad as when he's chasing that VW microbus.
For me, at least, it's hard to imagine that romantic subplot in this movie. It definitely feels like that is another movie completely once you introduce that. And I'm not sure I would like the movie as much, you know, no matter how well done it is. I actually think the absence of that in John's life is such a defining thing that it would actually be difficult for me to envision this film with a romantic subplot like that.
Other than Jolene, this film really is the story of men. You know, there's not that many women that are in the film. And Jolene is, in the version that, you know, we've seen, she is very much this temptress, betrayer. You know, she betrays Harv's confidences, betrays John, basically, to Harv. John didn't know that she was going out with Harv, and, you know, throws him under her bus, as it were, her VW microbus. So yeah, it's like the one woman that's in the final film completely can't be trusted, and the rest of the story is all men and the way that they're interacting with one another, which is kind of an interesting thing that male-centric the whole thing is.
Yeah, and you know, I guess I hadn't always thought so much about the gender breakdown, but really there are no characters that you could trust in the film. You know, John is the only character who really seems to be trustworthy. So the fact that the lone woman in the film is untrustworthy, you know, just struck me as being an extension of the fact that nobody can be trusted in the film. But it is interesting to think about it from that perspective, that these are all men trapped in this place, and there are very few women. And the one woman that they've both happened to be involved with is, you know, as deceptive and as much of a betrayer as everything else in their life. I mean, it definitely doesn't strike the most positive view of the world.
The screenplay is 151 pages, so it would have been a much longer film had it been filmed this way. Again, you know, to your earlier point about pulling out 20 pages, and there you have it. It might have been these 20 pages towards the end here that got yanked, because they're just gone. Yeah, but yeah, I think it is a stronger film without that character, with us just following John, and he is very much a lonely character, and I don't think it would have served our purposes as an audience to see him with somebody and to have that extra facet to his life. And really, for me, pardon the pun, but he's just so driven to be a detective that that's his only goal. And so, yeah, to see him defeated afterwards, it's like, okay, now how is he going to deal with this? So you get him going up to that one point where he's just about, you know, we can see him maybe helping out Harv and maybe getting, you know, like the sergeant keeps telling him that he's not getting any response on his detective exam. But maybe that would have, you know, the old boy network would have put him into a place where he could have been a detective. But we're not going to see that. And John goes right back to being on that bike, being trapped. And then we get his reaction to that, which I find fascinating.
I hate that motorcycle they make me ride. I'm here to tell you there ain't nothing in the world I hate worse than that elephant under my ass.
Boy, look at this meat and potatoes, John. Man, that Wonder Woman is really built.
As much as the film is kind of discouraging in some ways, because it seems to offer the opinion that going after what you want is in no way any sort of guarantee that it will happen, I do like that it doesn't work out for John. I like that it doesn't work out for him, and it doesn't work out for him in no way because he makes the wrong choices or bad choices or is not a good character. The system is set up to defeat him. And that goes back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier about, you know, the political attitudes of the times. So, you know, the sense that nothing is working out for anybody on any side of the fence, that, you know, regardless of where you're at on the political spectrum, that things, the ground beneath you seems to be unstable.
Even though John has been defeated and is not a detective anymore, he's still the one that solves the case. And the way that he does that, the way that he's just sitting there thinking and talking to that janitor, the completely impassive janitor, I love that scene. And that scene isn't in the screenplay. You know, that one is really shocking to me, because that's such a pivotal moment where he's talking about what good he does, you know, every day while he's out patrolling and that stuff, and that the janitor is doing more good. You know, you can see his progress as he's sweeping the floor versus John, who's just constantly in this battle and stuff. And that's when he figures out what happened with the murder and solves the murder, basically. And even though he solves the murder, still nothing. Still gets no kudos or anything at all. He does it, tries to convince Harv what actually happened. Harv really doesn't want any part of it either. And he just kind of goes back to his ways and goes back to patrolling. And then you have that scene with Zipper towards the end, which just that one, I had to rewatch that scene I don't know how many times when I first saw the movie, just because I was so confused as to what's going on. What is your interpretation of that scene?
Well, I'm not sure I recognize the confusion, so I'll tell you my interpretation of the scene, but I never saw it as something that, you know, where there was room for a lot of interpretation, so I'm actually really curious to hear your take. But my interpretation of the scene is that Zipper has taken money and used it to fulfill his dream, and is now terrified about being found out. That the guilt of having done this is eating at him, that he has what he wants but doesn't, you know, feel that he can enjoy it, and knows that John ultimately is going to turn him in, and, you know, reacts the way that he does.
I guess my confusion was that I wasn't sure if Zipper had been involved in the murder or not, or if he just saw the money while they were looking through Frank's place, or if he had actually come in there and shot Frank and then set up the whole suicide thing. Because Willie doesn't seem that mentally capable to have done that scene that you see at the beginning. But then again, Zipper wouldn't be cooking pork chops either.
Yeah, I guess I had never interpreted it that he may have been involved with the murder, although that's an interesting take and certainly falls in line with the film maintaining this kind of ambiguity about, you know, who actually committed the murder. But I always interpreted it that he had taken the money from the scene.
Okay. See, now that makes sense as well, but that's why I had to watch it over and over again, because I was just like, I'm not sure when he took the money. Did he take it from the scene? Did he take it recently? Did he go back afterwards? Because they go back to that shack a few times, you know, and when Harv finds all those reds that were in the pod and everything. And again, Harv using his intuition, which I find very fascinating. You know, he's very intuitive about that. Or does he really know what's going on? You know, there's that level of ambiguity as well. Did he know about Willie and Frank selling drugs? Did he know about the $5,000? Did he know about this? Did he know about that? You never really know. But then again, Harv does kind of come across as slightly clueless when John is explaining why Willie had, why Frank had shot Willie. I hate these generic names, you know, why Elijah Cook Jr. killed the guy that we never see on screen.
My guess is that anything that you pick up on the film that seems to make it more ambiguous as to the identity of the killer is probably not an accident. I mean, it's one of the things that they're clearly going for in the film, is not offering you any kind of definitive resolution. The stunts in this film are really surprisingly good. There's actually a shot of somebody coming off of a bike and hitting the ground, and their head actually connects with the ground, that just looks unbelievably brutal. And there's the sequence where the chase is occurring and one of the motorcyclists catches on fire, just over and over again. I mean, I feel like stunts in 1973 weren't quite as aggressive as Garcia was in this film. And I don't know if that's an attempt to push things further than they had been. But the first time I saw this movie, I was really taken aback by how aggressive the stunt work was. I was not anticipating that at all.
One of the few times where we get to see Peter Cetera, lead singer of Chicago, acting for one scene, but hey, you know, and I think it was him on the motorcycle before the stunts happened. But yeah, those stunts are amazing. I love those. I love the whole chase scene that you have. And it's fairly isolated, that sequence of stunts that are in there, other than the one at the very end. But yeah, just terrific work. And it really satiates you that, you know, these guys are riding motorcycles and it's a very dangerous thing, but you don't really get that danger until that scene. And then when you do, it's just completely balls to the wall.
Throughout the movie, you're watching John and Zipper carry out their duties, and you get the sense maybe that what they do is not that trying on them, or that, you know, there's no real level of mastery involved with what they do. And that's the moment in the film where you actually realize that there is a lot of danger to what they do, and they are putting their lives on the line. And the film kind of avoids showing you that. It usually shows these sort of casual encounters. Mostly they're sitting around on their bikes. And then all of a sudden, in this one sequence, you realize just how dangerous their lives can be.
Right. And we should also talk a little bit. I mean, I mentioned Peter Cetera of Chicago, and that Garcia was involved with Chicago. Just the soundtrack for the film is really, really nice. I mean, just the all of the songs really add to the film overall. But there are some, like with Wintergreen getting ready at the very beginning, that it's just takes your breath away as you're watching this, and the images and the sound and the songs, I should say, just really meld together in a very beautiful way. And I think that had Garcia maybe spent more time doing soundtrack work, I think that he could have just been absolutely terrific at soundtrack work, because he really had a notion as far as what music goes very well with a scene.
Yeah, I think if you didn't know his background before you saw the film and then found out afterwards, you would probably not be terribly surprised to know that, you know, his background was in producing records. And I think it also contributes to how well edited the film is and how well paced things are. You know, the film seems to be arranged in a way that is very musical, you know, where things get slower and faster, et cetera. And when you look back on it now, I think it doesn't feel like the same pacing of a lot of films at that time. It feels kind of distinctive and unique. And I think a huge part of that comes from Garcia's musical background and taking a different approach to how scenes cut together.
Overall, I don't think that I've really have said this, but overall, the film just, it does feel very different from anything that I've ever seen before as far as that pacing goes. And just the way that the story structure is put together, that could be because of the way that things had to be cut, the way that things are like literally out of the screenplay, the scenes had to be gone, or it could just be this, you know, very unique sensibility coming to a project where he hadn't had the experience before, coming to it, had that musical background, but didn't have the audiovisual marriage kind of thing going on, and then to come in there and create this thing, and again, surrounded himself with smart people. I mean, Conrad Howell's cinematography, photography, just gorgeous. The acting, I think, is top notch, despite the reviews that you may have referenced there. But I think you and I are on the same page as far as that goes. But you're not going to see another film that looks and moves like this one does for a very long time, because it really kind of stands alone. It stands alone, too, in that it is, as you mentioned earlier, taking that opposite side of the coin. You know, we were getting a lot of counterculture films. We weren't getting the cops. And this film really does give us that look at the authority, and that things weren't a bed of roses for them either. You know, you get the story of the girl who puts the daisy in the gun, but you don't really get the story of the guy who's holding the gun. And this is the guy who's holding the gun. He's the person that's in charge, trying to do the right thing, and no matter what, there's always going to be a snafu for him.
Yeah, the impossibility of that situation in trying to maintain authority when the system is not set up for you to be able to. It's really a beautifully tragic story. You know, it's about a man who has a very specific goal and has the capabilities to achieve that goal. And throughout the story, you know, circumstances keep coming up that deny him the ability to realize that. I mean, it's really a film in which victory is not an option. And that's kind of wonderful in a lot of ways, I think.
All right, so let's take a break and play a clip from next week's show.
Gentlemen, I hold the case that contains a real live girl.
Take the girl to Jupiter, trade her for the boy, bring the boy to Venus, trade him for Johnny R, bring Johnny R back to Earth, and I get rich.
That's it.
All right, and we're back. That was a clip from next week's show, all about the American astronaut. Josh is going to be coming back for that one, and we'll also be joined by frequent Projection Booth guest host Skiz Cizik. I want to thank you, Josh, for coming on the show. Before I let you go, I want to hear about the documentary that you're working on.
Well, the documentary is currently titled Rewind This. That may change as, you know, we head towards completion. And it's intended to be the definitive documentary about the home video revolution, what that impact was, what videotape coming to the marketplace did for the world, and how it changed the way people both make and consume media. So we've been interviewing people from distributors, from manufacturers, filmmakers, experts, collectors, everybody that we can get in touch with to try to tell that story in the most complete fashion possible. At this point, we've shot about 80 hours of footage, and we're going to shoot about 10 to 15 more in Japan next May, and we're currently raising funds to go on that trip.
Japanese VHS, a very expensive proposition. Back when I was collecting VHS tapes, which I know just sounds completely archaic, but when I was, just how pricey they were over there. They never really had like a consumer price for stuff.
No, yeah, the sell-through market didn't come at quite the same time there the way it did over here. The other thing that's so fascinating to me about the Japanese video story is that their direct-to-video market, once it came into being, never really had the same stigma that, you know, it did in the Western world. You know, it was always a lesser thing to be making direct-to-video movies in English-speaking parts of the world. But in Japan, really respected filmmakers could move back and forth from direct-to-video projects and theatrical projects without that judgment, and it actually offered them opportunities to be creative on a lower budget and really try some new things. So it'll be interesting to talk to those filmmakers, I think, and get their perspective on what home video enabled, because I think for them it was probably a more positive creative force than it was for some of the Western filmmakers.
There was that stigma in the U.S. Just there was the hot single shelf at Blockbuster where I worked, and just you knew everything that came in, single title only, was going to be something that was shot and directed and dumped to VHS, and it was kind of a wasteland, even though it was a very popular shelf. So that was where you got a lot of the softcore, Skinemax kind of stuff when cable was kind of going through its decline and VHS was king.
Yeah, you know, it was an interestingly democratic time. You know, big budget Hollywood fare and micro budget shot on video films would often be standing right next to each other on the video box shelf. So while they were coming from completely different backgrounds and certainly, you know, not even attempting the same thing, it really came down to just looking at a box and making a choice. So, I mean, you really did have an opportunity as a small scale filmmaker to get a far better chance at getting into somebody's hands than you ever would have at any previous time, because you were literally just sat there right next to the biggest film of the week.
Right, and it didn't hurt if your title was very similar either.
This is true. I mean, they still do that. That's, of course, what The Asylum has become known for doing.
So how long have you been working on this?
I've been working on it with two partners since June of last year. And, you know, we've been to California, Washington, New York, around the state of Texas. And we've set up contacts around the world, and now we're going to be going to Japan. But we're most of the way through completion. You can actually go to our site and view a teaser trailer and see more information about it there.
Cool. And the URL is?
It is www.rewindthismovie.com.
And if folks want to help out at all, whether they've got stories or contacts or cold hard cash, is there a donate section on the site?
There's a donate section on the site, and there's a link to a Kickstarter for our completion funding on there where you can see the teaser trailer and contribute there. And all awesome. Of our contact information is on there as well. So we're easy to get in touch with.
All right, terrific. And then you're on Twitter too, right?
Yeah, the film itself has an account, which is at Rewind This Movie. And then you can find me and my personal musings on there at VHS is the truth.
Thanks again, Josh, for coming on. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure talking to you today. Hopefully we'll have more of you in the future. I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask for a response now, though you will be on next week when we talk about The American Astronaut. So thanks again, folks, for listening. Check out more episodes of The Projection Booth via iTunes, via Stitcher, or on Jackalope Radio. And be sure to visit the website projection-booth.com, where you can support the show's sponsors. All right, let's roll. Thank you.
I don't know what I can tell you. I'm not good at talking about it, you know.